From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, 100 years of codebreaking. In this month's second episode, celebrating the anniversary of the creation of GCHQ, where better to learn more about those 100 years than in the heart of its current headquarters? We were given special permission to record within the walls of the famous Donut Building in Cheltenham. Our guide to those top secret corridors is GCHQ's new official historian, David Abratat. With a century of codebreaking behind them, there's a rich history to dive into, and it's not just about Bletchley Park. The team at today's Bletchley Park have marked GCHQ's centenary with a new display called From GCNCS to GCHQ. We find out about some of the people and stories in the exhibition from those behind its creation. A very special thanks to GCHQ for allowing us to record this exclusive episode.
David, how are you finding being GCHQ's official historian that we've outed now?
Well, I find it, quite honestly, a genuine privilege. I mentioned this to quite a few people. It's an honour and a privilege to have the job and to be the custodian of our rich and varied history. Tony's, a hard act to follow, but I'm hopefully going to do it justice over the next few years. I've got a genuine passion for history, and this year is our centenary year. It's a really important milestone for us as an organisation.
I suppose, in a way, because you've worked for the organisation in an operational role, then carrying on as a historian, it's a different feeling for someone who just gets a job somewhere as a historian, I imagine.
It gives you a real foundation, the background knowledge that you've got from the experiences you've had working in operations, seeing the difference that SIGINT, signals intelligence, makes in the real world, not just to the government, to the politicians, but to the warfighter on campaigns in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. It puts it into perspective.
Yeah.
And then, the role I have now is to, essentially look back. But we can learn a lot of lessons from history. And this is one of the things I want to really bring into the role, is conveying what we've learned historically into the current and to the present, and making sure we don't repeat mistakes.
So we're actually sat inside GCHQ. Absolutely honoured again to have been allowed in here to record. I've gone through security again. It's a little more secure this time than last time. I didn't think it could get any more secure. We on the Bletchley Park podcast could probably be accused of doing World War II to death, but that's because we are telling the story of people who worked at Bletchley Park between 1939 and 1945. But those 6 years at Bletchley Park are only 6 years. There's another 94 years of history. So because it's the centenary, I think it's well overdue time that we look back at those 100 years. So 1919 is the year that GCHQ is formed, but SIGINT actually starts before then, doesn't it?
Yeah, it predates 1919 by a margin, really. And we can really trace back some of the roots almost back to the Boer War. So the cables sent by the Boers during the war to their allies in France and Germany were intercepted in Aden, of all places.
Really?
Due to the way the telegraphic cabling system was configured. But our first UK cryptographic bureau was actually opened in northern India, a place called Simla, in 1905, which was intercepting communications on Russian activity in Afghanistan and in the Far East. So we've got a rich history that predates the First World War.
So I think Tiltman in the 20s or 30s was in India, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
So let me just talk you through World War One. We all can visualise the slaughter and carnage of trench warfare in Flanders. But going back to the beginning of the First World War, it was actually the French who led the development of telephone interception on the Western Front. They developed the first experimental listening post in November 1914, but established a permanent station in April 1915 near Verdun. And they were using Alsatians and language teachers to listen to German communications.
Alsatians, as in people from Alsace-Lorraine.
Yeah.
Because we should probably point out to people at this point, we're talking pre-wireless, aren't we, really, here?
We are, yeah.
And that's why you're saying telephones, because everything was wired, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The field telephone systems that were employed on both sides were a necessary evil, but they were also vulnerable to interception at the time. So the British War Office had a section a very small section called MO5B, which was created in 1914 under the leadership of a Brigadier Anderson, who also led the cryptanalytic efforts during the Boer War. He started to tackle German military ciphers. As you mentioned there, the new technology of wireless telegraphy is being used extensively by the German army for command and control for the first time in warfare during its rapid advance through Belgium and France. July, August 1915, the British Expeditionary Force undertook a number of experiments. That was led by a Captain William Batchelor, who is an experienced telephone engineer. He built some quite rudimentary, simple apparatus which could intercept German telephone calls from up to 100 yards away.
This is not through a direct connection?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
And the Germans had a much better system, which we call the Maritz system, which used equipment from the mining industry. They could intercept at distances up to 3,000 yards. So they were actually much better at that stage of the war. The Allies gathered intelligence on the system from prisoners of war. So they learnt a lot of the tradecraft directly from prisoners. But at the end of 1915, this small war office section, MO5B, only had four staff. So it was a really small, niche unit. And a chap called Major Malcolm Vivian Hay became its head, and he was very keen to expand it and its remit. And he rebadged it MI1B in 1916. And as a former Royal Marine, I can't ignore the senior service for obvious reasons.
Yes.
They had also a group of cryptanalysts in the Admiralty building and a room called Room 40. That was established in October 1914. One of the main catalysts for this team to be set up was a captured German naval codebook and maps that the Russians actually gave us. At this stage, the Russians were our friends. Yep. They were taken off a German cruiser, the Magdeburg, after it ran aground off the Estonian coast in August 1914. In 1916, the British found their frontline communications were insecure, and it led to this symbiotic relationship between communications security and signals intelligence, which has been the foundation for GCHQ. And it's this poacher-turned-gamekeeper relationship that a lot of countries all over the world have a very similar dynamic with their intelligence services. So I quote, "There is still far too much telephone conversation on our telephone circuits. Therefore, it behoves all officers and senior NCOs in charge of circuits to make every possible precaution to be said or sent over the telephone line that may in any way convey information to the enemy. And it must be an absolute rule that only necessary messages are sent. Some very bad cases of carelessness with regard to messages have been detected." And the army developed a new branch of Royal Engineers, which became known as the Signal Service. They were designated as interpreter operators. Between 20 and 30 listening stations were established by the end of 1916. But around late 1916, the German battlefield communications really shifted towards this greater use of wireless telegraphy. So the dynamic changed around that time. But the senior officers in General Headquarters, General Haig himself, were really, really avid readers of the daily intelligence summaries. There was an appetite.
Well, anything for an advantage. And the stalemate they were suffering, wasn't it?
So we're going into January 1917. One of the most famous bits of SIGINT history was the German Foreign Minister, Arthur Zimmermann, who sent a telegram to the German embassies in Washington and Mexico City. At this time, the Germans wanted to carry out unrestricted submarine warfare in the Atlantic, and that was going to start on the 1st of February 1917. They were concerned that that might sink some American merchant ships coming across the Atlantic, and in doing so could bring the Americans into the war. So Zimmermann was really keen to propose an alliance with Mexico, giving them carte blanche to retake Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, areas which had been taken from Mexico 70 years prior. And it was Room 40 who intercepted that telegram, decrypted it, and gave it to the Americans. And as a subsequence, in April 1917, the US Senate declared war against Germany.
We've interviewed both Anthony and Michael de Grey, who were the grandsons of Nigel de Grey, who decrypted that message. And their father as well, John de Grey, actually went on to work at Bletchley Park in World War II, same as Nigel did. But Nigel was such a leading light in code-breaking, wasn't he?
He was, yep. And that really drew in neutral America. And, you know, the repercussions of that one piece of intercept had a seismic effect. And it is a really interesting piece of SIGINT history right there.
And am I right? At that time, in 1917, America didn't even have an intelligence service, did it?
No. It didn't. And certainly the British were pioneering an approach, obviously working very closely with the French on the battlefield, and the realisation how important the cryptanalytic effort was to the war machine. You know, it really resonated. One of the most interesting items we've got from this period in our archives is actually an intercept log from a joint British and ANZAC being the Australians and New Zealand Army Corps, from a site in Basra, of all places, in what was then Mesopotamia. And it really highlights the beginnings of what we call traffic analysis, showing the metadata around the collected signals, things like the frequency and time up, time down. It's one of only three in existence, and it's one of the most interesting things we've got in our archives of this period.
So that would have been targeting the Ottomans or the Turkish troops, as we think of them now.
One of Britain's first actions of the war was a master stroke of communication sabotage. On the night of the 4th of August 1914, five of Germany's six cables in the English Channel were cut. The sixth cable was redirected to be used by the British to intercept German communications. Britain had already recognised the importance of cable. Not only were UK cables protected from interference, many foreign powers were forced to use Britain's extensive network for their own messaging. Britain was in the ideal position to intercept friends and foes alike.
My relation, as far as the First World War is concerned, was Nigel de Grey, my grandfather, a decoder. Of course, I didn't know anything about that until just after 1973, I think, when either Mr. Kahn or his representative who wrote the book, The Code Breakers, came to our house and asked us to identify his writing. The bit of paper that he showed us was, as I now know, the Zimmermann telegram, and it was in German, and there were letters written in English above a number of the words and phrases. And my mother and I were asked whether we recognised Nigel de Grey's writing on that paper. And we both said, without hesitation, that is his writing. And although there were other people's writing on it as well, it was clear to us that the substance, the main part of it, was in his writing, and that, as is now known, he was the person who was the main decoder, although he was assisted by Montgomery and Knox in this. And the Zimmermann telegram is one of the major factors in the First World War. And, of course, the Americans were infuriated and horrified. And this is what brought the Americans into the war. And as my grandfather is reputed to have said, and this is entirely hearsay, at a meeting in the office a few days later, once the Americans joined the war, "Ladies and gentlemen, the toast is America, because now we are going to win the war."
Very unusual message. It doesn't seem to follow the standard patterns of naval terminology. Codes can be so damn tricky to break without a crib. A practice code. Sent by the operator, perhaps. "The sailor in room 53 has never, it's true, been to sea. But though not in a boat, he'll serve to float in a bathtub in the Admiralty." Maybe it is a song. Let's assume that the repetition of is the most common of German syllables, un.
"Mr. Knox? Mr. Knox, I know that you're in the bath, but do you need me to take down any codes that you've deciphered during the night?"
"Miss Rodham, I must speak with Dr. Willoughby at once."
Another interesting thing about Nigel was that at that time he was great friends with one of his relations, really very close friends, and this relation more or less cut him off during the First World War because he couldn't understand why he wasn't wearing uniform, whereas he was in the trenches. So Nigel was somewhat mystified by this, I think, but it would appear that they met again in spite of this. Indeed, it said that Nigel sought out this relation, and he obviously said something, because in those days there was no Official Secrets Act, but he said enough to this relation for the relation to say, "Ah, I see. It was you who won the war, not me in the trenches." Again, I can't absolutely vouch for it, but it does come from a good family source, that particular story.
By the time the war ended, MI1B employed just under 90 people. Britain had become a world leader in the field of intelligence. In 1919, Alistair Denniston, a Room 40 linguist and codebreaker, headed a carefully selected group of Room 40 and MI1B employees, forming the new Government Code and Cipher School.
So all in all, would you say we were quite successful in World War One?
We were. I think the Germans led the way to a point. The French obviously were picking up some of the new developments, working aggressively on the front line in intercepting tactical communications. But there was a bigger effort with the War Office and the Admiralty setting up independent cryptanalytic units to break into German ciphers. And that really led the foundation to what became our organisation.
Because in April 1919, at the peace conference that's happening at Versailles, there were actually staff from both MI1B and Room 40 from the Admiralty actually working for the British deciphering German diplomatic traffic then, weren't they? Because the gentleman I think we're probably going to talk about next is there working, and that's Alistair Denniston.
Yeah, it was really the mainstay of the direction and leadership that Alistair Denniston brought to the organisation when it was established on the 1st of November.
Why was it decided to join an AB1 organisation, do you know?
The British Cabinet accepted a recommendation by Lord Curzon's Secret Service Committee for a peacetime cryptanalytic unit to be formed. I think the realisation was the value that could be sought from a specialist unit to work against our adversaries. And the task was given to the then Director of Naval Intelligence, a Captain Sir Hugh Sinclair, to review the current status quo. And the proposal was put forward to amalgamate what was then MI1B and the Admiralty's Room 40 staff into a new organisation, a new entity, which became known as GC&CS, the Government Code and Cipher School. And that was formed officially on the 1st of November 1919 in a new office at Watergate House, which is just off the embankment in London, under the leadership of Alistair Denniston. The original complement was only 94 staff, so it was small but perfectly formed.
When GC&CS is formed, obviously it's come from remnants of two departments, one working directly for the Admiralty, for the Navy, and one working more for the Army. Do they stay under military control? And if so, you know, are the Army and the Navy having a fight about who controls it?
There was a lot of politics, as there still is to this day. 1st of April 1922, the unit, the Government Code and Cipher School, transferred from Admiralty control to the Foreign Office, who in turn then left it to be administered by C, who was the then, or still is, the head of SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6.
Would it have come under control of the Foreign Office? Because at this time, what was their biggest targets? Was it diplomatic traffic?
At this period of time, it was very focused on Russian and Bolshevik subversion generally, which defying that sort of interwar period, there was an awful lot of resources dedicated to diplomatic traffic.
And that therefore makes sense that it comes under the auspices of the Foreign Office, doesn't it?
Going back to the military side, the military signals intelligence traffic was very much left to the military itself. And the Army had sites at this time in Iraq and Palestine. The Royal Navy had sites in Hong Kong and Malta. But all three services had sites directly in the UK, collecting and intercepting traffic. There's an interesting year in this interwar period, which was 1926. This is when the infamous Enigma first came on the market. The chap that founded the company, Arthur Scherbius, actually came up with the idea and the concept at the end of the First World War. But an interesting story is Edward Travis, who is one of our senior officers in GC&CS, went to Berlin to buy one. I mean, it was very much a commercial cipher machine at the time for the banking sector.
It's this part of the story that I love, because for the whole story of Enigma being secret for so long and being told that they had to have an Enigma to actually break it, and we realise now that you don't actually have to have an Enigma to break it, but the biggest reveal for me was a few years ago when I found out that, well, actually we bought two of them back in 1926. It's another one of these myths that we can help to bust, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's no better substitute than actually getting your hands on these machines, you know, to work out the circuitry and pulling them apart. And that really stepped us forward in our understanding of the machine itself. But it was the beginning of 1927. Hugh Foss, who'd been given the machine by Travis, you know, he literally worked out the nuts and bolts of the machine itself and produced a paper which was referred to as the Reciprocal Enigma. I found some interesting insight in 1932 of how new recruits were needed within the organisation. So 1932, many of the original World War I intake were retiring. So the organisation put out essentially a recruitment advert, which highlights the first organisational recruitment process. Although there was no sort of formal qualifications required, there were paper sifts and then interviews done by a selection board. And I quote, "A certain degree of mathematical aptitude is of the first importance, while mathematical knowledge is of no importance. Linguistic aptitude is important, and a knowledge of modern language is also desirable. Candidates must satisfy the civil service commissioners as to their health and character. Female candidates must be unmarried or widows and will be required to resign their appointment on marriage."
That was actually standard practice within the British civil service. Well, up till, I think, the 50s or 60s, possibly, yes, if not later even.
Certainly up until World War II, it was general practice.
What's interesting there is that they're specifically saying that they're still looking for linguists at that point and not mathematicians.
Yeah, and I think we only had one actual real mathematician during this period of time, which is interesting.
Because we know how code breaking is going to move forward and how it's going to move into this machine age. And this is just prior to that. It can't be long after that that Denniston actually starts his recruitment drive where he's looking for the professor types, is it?
Yeah. 1932 is an interesting one in the sort of history timeline. Polish mathematician and cryptanalyst Marian Radziewski broke the original Enigma encipherment procedures whilst working with the Polish Cipher Bureau. With a bit of input from the French and other cryptanalysts, they managed to break into the actual German Enigma messages for the first time in early 33. So this sort of period in the early 30s was really significant in that Enigma journey for Bletchley.
But as for GCNCS, the Germans weren't even our target, were they?
No, they weren't. We step forward to 1936, the Spanish Civil War. And Hitler, at the time, wanted to bolster Franco's forces and sent what was known as the German Condor Legion, who were deployed to Spain. They sent with them 10 Enigma machines. And it was the first time that we started intercepting the traffic. The original traffic was between Mussolini's navy and Franco's navy, and we were picking up the signals directly. 26th, 27th of July 1939 was quite a famous meeting in the Priory Forest near Warsaw. French, Poles and British intelligence representatives came together. Really, really foundation meeting. Really, really important to share knowledge on the Enigma decryption techniques. And it really leapfrogged the organisation into breaking the Axis Enigma traffic during the war. And to me, it reflects the value of partnerships, working collaboratively with other countries, which is still embedded in our DNA to this very day.
Well, at the centenary event at the National Memorial Arboretum the other week, there were representatives of all five of the Five Eyes nations, weren't there?
Yeah, and Bletchley was most certainly the crucible for the Yakuza partnership, so our partnership directly with the Americans, which goes back to 1941, really the tendrils of it. And then after the war, the birth of the Five Eyes partnership, which is the biggest, strongest signals intelligence partnership in the world. And at this time, GCNCS and SIS or MI6 were co-located at one location, which was on 54 Broadway. But at this time, there was a lot of fear about, the start of the Second World War. There was genuine fear about the bombing.
The bomber will get through.
Yeah. So we originally moved into Bletchley on the 15th of August 1939. The staff at Bletchley were given some original advice on ComSec.
And what's ComSec then?
Communications security. The staff are warned against any conversations regarding the work with other members of staff within their billets. If occasion should arise as to what you are doing, the answer should be that you are part of the aerial defence of London.
That's from the movement order at the beginning of August. Those documents are so quintessentially British 1930s. Sort of, you can tell the person who's written it was saying it in RP. They're
right.
Really, in some ways, so quaint.
2nd of August 1939. Move of service sections to war site, 15th of August 1939. In order to carry out communication tests, the war site will be manned AM 15th August by those detailed in GCNCS first wave, who are not on leave at the time. All documents required at the war site are to be packed by 5:30 PM on 14th August. They will be moved during that night. As many as possible are to be placed in small cupboards and filing cabinets which can be locked. Arrangements for labelling will be promulgated later. Stationery has already been sent down. Sufficient personal luggage should be taken for 15 days. Those going by train should obtain a single ticket of the appropriate class to Bletchley. On arrival, they should place their luggage in the cloakroom, from whence it will be collected after the allocation of billets, etc. They should proceed on foot from the station to the war side, inquiring if necessary for Bletchley Park, which is on the up or west side of the railway. On leaving the station, turn right up the hill and proceed through the second lodge gates. Suitable trains from Euston are the 8:37 a.m. and the 9:30 a.m. An advance for railway tickets can be obtained from Mr. Travis. The address for official correspondence and private letters will be Room 47 Foreign Office, and the official telephone number, Whitehall 7947. The staff are warned against any conversations regarding the work with other members of the staff whilst in their billets. If occasion should arise as to what you are doing, the answer should be that you are part of the aerial defence of London. This test is to be treated with the utmost secrecy by all members of this department. Gas masks are to be taken.
These are today's main events. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns. General mobilization has been ordered in Britain and France. It is stated in London on the highest authority that if the proclamation of Herr Hitler should mean, as it would seem to mean, that Germany has declared war on Poland, Great Britain and France are inflexibly determined to fulfill to their uttermost their obligations to the Polish government.
The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest. Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered, and enslaved. Tens of thousands of square miles of territory shrink before the movement of lightning-armored columns. Poland and the world learn the meaning of a grim new word. Blitzkrieg. The spark is set off in the free city of Danzig. Germany called it liberation. The excuse for Hitler's hordes to begin their destructive campaign of conquest. On September 1st, Danzig is incorporated into the Reich, and all Europe is aflame.
Alter Soldat des Weltkrieges befindet sich der Führer seit Beginn des Feldzuges an der Front bei seinen Soldaten.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Very, very small GCNCS team also moved into Mansfield College in Oxford.
Because that's something I don't think we've ever talked about. So what happened there? Tell us about that, because that's really interesting.
There was about 20 staff moved to Mansfield. So Mansfield College was put to Oxford because of the Oxford University Press, the OUP. They, obviously, being a printing press at a university, had a long history of producing and printing examination papers. Yeah. So they were used to working in secret, and they were requisitioned by the War Office.
Were they producing documents for Bletchley Park to do their job? So, you know, copies of German code books or something? Or do we know what they were actually producing?
They were producing a lot of code books and one-time pads for Bletchley Park and things of that nature for the Allied military who, you know, were deploying internally in the UK but also overseas in occupied Europe and elsewhere. So they had a team of, certainly at the start of the war, there was 20, but that grew over the course of the war to 300 staff at Mansfield College because it was such a big production effort. Really into that Second World War period now in Bletchley Park, and I don't want to overlabor the point that, you know, this period of 6 years was really a defining period in our history And, you know, we're very proud of that Bletchley heritage. 10,000 people worked there at the height of the war. You know, 3/4 of the staff there were women. But the technological development there, the code-breaking effort of the code-breaking group under Turing and Bill Tutt, was so significant to our, almost our DNA as an organisation.
Well, and also significant for the naming of the organisation after the war, because it's actually Nigel de Grey who comes up with the term GCHQ as, well, let's use this as one of the covers, on a board outside GC and CS, isn't it?
That's right. I think they found government code and cipher school too descriptive an acronym, so they started to use government communications headquarters, and the name was used, certainly informally, but it wasn't really formally adopted until after the war.
But it was being used as early as 1940, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Going back to the first Enigma decrypt in January 1940, using concepts derived from the Polish Cipher Bureau, they developed these bomber machines to have some electromechanical machines semi-automate the process of decrypting the Enigma traffic. What's interesting to draw out of that, we went forward in the development program to build a significant number of these electromechanical machines and the bombs to industrialise the breaking of Enigma traffic with the British Tabulating Machinery Company in Letchworth under the direction of Harold Keane. There was £2 million of investment put into that bomb programme. At the time, the biggest single investment in British intelligence history. So the first bomb was installed in March 1940 and given the name Victory. But it's interesting that the US Navy and the US Army produced similar machines. If you go to the States, just outside NSA, there is a museum. And in there, they have one of the original bombs on display, which is just fantastic.
And they do look a lot different to the bomb that we designed.
Yeah, that's right.
And also, of course, that first bomb, we should remember that, you know, the father of the bomb is Alan Turing, who designs the bomb. But Gordon Welshman has a big hand in making the bomb work properly, doesn't he? Because after the first bomb, he designs the diagonal board.
I mean, it's astonishing the level of intellect behind some of the processes that they matured within a fairly small team at Bletchley. And that really, you know, pushed us forward. You know, the story's been told a lot at Bletchley, and rightly so. You know, we should be nationally very proud of what happened at Bletchley. January 1941, 4 Americans arrive at Bletchley Park, 2 US Navy, 2 Army personnel. They had free access to Bletchley, but they weren't specifically cited on what we were doing against the Enigma. But there was a famous memo that was sent from C to the Prime Minister on the 26th of February 1941. I quote, to bring them in, essentially to be completely transparent with what we were doing at Bletchley. Interestingly, as the course of the war developed, by the end of the war, there were 130 Americans at Bletchley Park, embedding that partnership that is as strong today as it was then. And it really became the basis of that Yakuza partnership, which was signed in 1946.
Because that follows on from the original Bruce partnership.
Yeah. And it's something we are collectively very proud of. And it's soon to be the 75th anniversary. It's astonishing how far that's come in our histories, our collective histories.
This is the BBC Home Service. We're interrupting programs to make the following announcement. It is understood that in accordance with arrangements between the three great powers, an official announcement will be broadcast by the Prime Minister at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon, the 8th of May.
Well, I was a bomb operator at Eastcote on Sea Watch. Sea Watch was actually on duty when they announced VE Day.
Yesterday morning, 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force.
So it stopped the following day. The chief officer gave us all a little pep talk. Well, I think she thought we were all going to lose our honour because of everybody feeling free and throwing away caution to the winds and celebrating and drinking. and we all rushed up to London and throwing crowds there outside the palace, shouting and marching them down Piccadilly with about 20 Canadian Air Force officers all arm in arm. Had a marvellous day. Came back to Eastcote the next day. It must have been the following day then that we then sat outside and smashed up the bombs. The Air Force boys, who were DCHQ engineers, they had dismantled the big things and we had all the small stuff and all these hundreds of drums. We had to take them apart. Everything was counted, screws and bearings and so on.
And now, at this moment, how wonderful, Mr. Churchill has come out onto the Ministry of Health balcony. Now Mr. Churchill stands on the balcony of the Ministry of Health.
Oh, we used to have fun, we did. I mean, most of the chaps that were there had done years in Italy and had come back and were really then working up to demob. So it wasn't a very dark time. And I remember VE night, I was in Trafalgar Square. Well, I was in that melee on VE night.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is every man. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Everyone, man or woman, has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all.
They were an extraordinary crowd. I mean, they were so wonderful, the code breakers. Nearly every new code they were trying to break was just so agonising, because every minute meant thousands of people's lives were at risk. We were lucky enough to be here at the right time, in the right place. We were able to do what we did because of that. It may be the most important thing that any of us ever done in our lives. We didn't realise it at the time, but we do now.
I look back that it was fun, and I look back at the fact that there was one moment when I did something which was really useful. I did once do something valuable for my country.
Your service was invaluable, and yes. Thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, it was lucky that we came to such an unusual and really rather sparkly place, even though we weren't allowed to see much of it. It was fun being here. The vibes were very good.
As the Second World War winds down, obviously GCNCS don't need as many staff and lots of people are demobbed. There's not just a big personnel change, there's actually a big change of site, isn't there? Because you move away from Bletchley Park.
That's right. April 1946, we officially became GCHQ. We moved from Bletchley to Eastcote, one of the bomb outstations during the war. But the organisation quickly outgrew the site, and towards the end of the 40s, the organisation was starting to look elsewhere.
Now, is that the point where you choose Cheltenham?
Yes.
Because driving here today, it suddenly dawned on me while I was sat at a set of traffic lights. Why Cheltenham?
There was a number of reasons, but the main one was the two sites, Oakley and Benhall, were during the war used by the Services of Supply, the SOS component of the US Army's logistics branch. After Pearl Harbor, the Americans wanted to set up some significant logistics footprint in the UK, and Cheltenham was taken for that reason. So they built two purpose-built logistics sites, and they were hardwired with some significant landline connections. And that was one of the main reasons. The capacity for communications at these two centres in Cheltenham would be the main swinger for coming here.
One of the theories that David, our historian, mentioned is everyone thinks of Bletchley being chosen for the war station because it was on the Varsity line between Cambridge and Oxford. But probably the bigger factor is the fact that the A5 is like less than a mile away, and the A5 held the trunk cables for the whole of the communications for Britain.
That's right.
Again, it shows the importance of communications to the organisation.
There's certainly an urban myth within our organisation that one of the directors had a penchant for racing and wanted the organisation to move to the town so he could watch the Gold Cup every year. But we've actually never found anything in the archives to corroborate the story. But it's nice we have such myths. 1952, GCHQ director, a chap called Eric Jones at the time, endorsed the move. And I quote, "The people of Cheltenham have accepted us wonderfully. Shopping is a real pleasure. It may take a little longer than in London, but the friendliness makes it well worthwhile." I think that's just a lovely quote.
And Eric Jones, as listeners will remember, ran Hut 3 during World War II. That's such a vital role, especially in the build-up to D-Day.
Yeah. So the Cold War period, as we all know, was defined by that Soviet target, the opposing Western and Eastern political blocs. But what isn't really known a lot is GCHQ was at the forefront of advances in transistors and the miniaturisation of technology up to the 1970s. And there's a key period in time here, 1973. Clifford Cox and Malcolm Williamson developed something called public key cryptography, which is essentially a protocol that's used in internet security to this day. So every time you're shopping on Amazon, the basis of that goes back to 1973 and GCHQ and two members of staff. But it was actually classified until 1997. 1983, it was really then that GCHQ gained national profile when its function was avowed to Parliament. That's a real year set in the diary.
Yeah, we wouldn't have been sitting here in 1982 doing this, would we?
No, very different time. And in 1991, jumping forward a decade, the collapse of the Soviet Union. I'm sure many listeners will remember the footage on the news. But it was also the year that the World Wide Web became publicly accessible. And the internet, you know, is the basis for so much of our life these days. But GCHQ really had to reinvent itself after the Cold War. And very much one of the things that's really changed with the organisation, we have a much flatter hierarchy than what we used to have in the early years of our organisation. 1994, the Intelligence Services Act came into place, which puts the activities of all three intelligence agencies on a legal footing. And it was 2003 that GCHQ moved into what we call the donut.
Where we're sat now.
A very iconic building on the edge of Cheltenham in Ben Hall. And I still think it is, to this day, the largest secret intelligence headquarters outside the US. 25th of March 2004, Her Majesty the Queen officially opened the donut. Really sort of proud day for us as an organisation, really sort of stamping our authority. But it's such an iconic building. And it's really fostered that open plan environment. It's changed our culture. We're much more open, and our internal inter-team communications has changed irrevocably because of the design of the building. It's fostered that cross-team working environment.
It's not quite back to the days of wooden huts at Bletchley Park and someone in one room not knowing what the next person in the next room's doing.
And really the last two decades really been defined by Afghanistan and Iraq, the campaigns and our support to military operations efforts, but also 7/7. You know, 2005 was a big game changer, whereby GCHQ's really ramped its support to MI5 in terms of counterterrorism work. In October 2016, we formally launched the National Cybersecurity Centre, which is based in Nova South in London. And it's really been a template that a lot of countries have taken forward for cybersecurity and advice to industry. But this year, 2019, it's our centenary year. It's a big year for us as an organisation. The organisation's very much on a different footing now. We're talking about decentralising Cheltenham. You know, Cheltenham's always been the sort of hub of everything since 1952.
Because you're going to be opening new offices in Manchester.
That's right. We've got a lot of history with Manchester and the birth of computing and links back to Bletchley. And it's really the birth of a new dawn for us. Our centenary year has been just filled with lots and lots of events. Going back to, say, May, we had 100 staff who did a bike ride for charity from Bletchley to Ben Hall.
Included the director, didn't it?
Yeah. We raised £43,000 for charity. It was a great event, apart from the weather. We've also had a very, very significant public exhibition open in the Science Museum, which opened in July, which runs until February next year. It's our biggest public exhibition ever. We've got 79 items from our collection, some of which have never been seen in the public domain before. You can go for free. It's a fantastic exhibition.
And tickets are still available to the public online.
That's right, yeah. You can get those on the Science Museum website. We're going to be moving that exhibition up to Manchester in October next year. So again, the importance of Manchester for us going forward for the future. We opened a centenary garden. We're working through the authorised history with a chap called Professor Ferris at the University of Calgary.
And as Tony said in the last episode, that book's been slightly delayed, hasn't it? But that's going to come out next year.
Yeah, that's right. It's our first authorised history. It's going to be a fantastic book for people to really understand 100 years of our history.
Now, with that, I guess there's going to be a lot more documentation released. Some Cold War has already been released. Is that part of your job? Do you have to go through that?
Yeah, that's right. We want to cover the full 100 years, but a lot of the most recent material to the end of the Cold War has not been released to the National Archives, but we're sequencing it all in conjunction with what Professor Ferris is planning.
Has anything really stood out for you with the centenary?
I could probably pick two of the events. Going back to Her Majesty the Queen unveiling a plaque on Watergate House, the first home of GCNCS in 1919, it solidifies 100 years of history to me. Whilst it's symbolic to me, yeah, it's a really important day for us as an organisation. But going back to the 1st of November, our official centenary event, yeah, at the National Memorial Arboretum, I sat at the back and I listened to the speeches and a lot of the narrative. And to me, I was very proud to be a member of staff. Yeah. I've worked here for 18 years. I've seen what we do. I've seen how we do it. I love working for GCHQ, and I was a very, very proud member of staff that day.
Bletchley Park veteran Betty Webb says that herself. And there's a continuity in a way that where Betty was talking to us about how she, in a way, was surprised by the youth of some of the current members of staff who stood up and made speeches. You know, it's no different to the staff when Betty started. There is that continuation, isn't there, through the years, all of the staff connected with what is now GCHQ.
Yeah, and it's certainly when we're doing a lot of our interviews with serving and former members of staff, it's one thing that is a common denominator across all of them is the pride that everybody has for working for our organisation and what we do.
As an outsider, you know, I have to say, it must in a way be gratifying to have a day like that because, albeit it wasn't a public event, it was more public than most events, you know, most of the organisation's work has to be unknown. Same as our veterans didn't speak about what they did for 30 years. So you're 18 years working in ops. It must seem like that is a thank you to you as well.
Yeah, I think so. But it just really resonated. Certainly bits of it were quite emotional. And I'm just thinking back to the event itself and just seeing some of the Bletchley veterans there and the pride they had just to be there. Yeah. I think it was absolutely fantastic.
And they do like a gentleman in a uniform as well.
Yes. And the canapes and champers were quite nice as well.
That's quite a canter through 100 years of GCHQ history. There are parts of this that I think we'll be picking up ourselves and probably parts that you'll be able to expand on in your new role, especially the post-war story I imagine you'll be working on.
Yeah, that's right. I'm very passionate about our history. We've got so many stories to tell and I'm really looking forward to future podcasts with Bletchley and, you know, making sure that some of these really interesting stories are conveyed publicly.
We will call on you again. That is if I'm let out of the building today. David, congratulations on the new role.
Thank you, Mark.
I'm glad that we got to officially announce you as the new historian. And thank you for your service as well.
Thank you, Mark. Pleasure.
Our listeners may have forgotten that you're not just the host of the Bletchley Park podcast. You actually have a real job, don't you, Erica?
I do. I'm the luckiest person in the world to be Bletchley Park's exhibitions manager.
As part of the GCHQ centenary celebrations, we're stood in front of your latest piece of work.
Yes, we have a display that we've called From GCNCS to GCHQ, And it looks at what happened as the organisation transitioned from being the wartime GCNCS to the post-war GCHQ.
Do you feel that a lot of people don't actually realise that there's a connection between Bletchley Park during the war and, you know, GCHQ that we have now?
I'd say that's true. I think quite a few of our visitors don't perhaps make that connection between what they know as the wartime codebreakers and what took place here with the famous donut building and the computer cyber work of GCHQ today.
Quite a lot of wartime staff went on either to carry on working with GCHQ or went back to GCHQ after the war, didn't they, later on?
Hundreds stayed on in the organisation. I mean, it definitely shrank post-war with the requirements of the service. But we know that a lot of staff did stay on in order to continue the work that they'd done and also for continuity of knowledge. And also the things that they learned obviously couldn't easily be passed on. So certain staff were able to stay in post and shape the post-war organisation. Interestingly, it wasn't just that it changed from GCNCS to GCHQ. It was actually being known as GCHQ during the war. And so we've been able to focus on that in this display a little bit about how there's these overlaps of name and place. Again, I think some people think that VE, VJ Day happened. They shut the door here and that was that.
Yeah, it wasn't quite that simple.
Exactly. There's this winding down that we've been able to pick up on a little bit of in this exhibition and show that there were certain continuities of machinery, for example. Again, it wasn't that every machine was shut down and the threat had disappeared. So obviously GCHQ, as it was then, its work continued. Staff wrote histories, cut histories and section reports, detailing and summarising what took place during the war so that lessons that had been learned could be transferred to the post-war staff.
It's only recently that GCHQ have released information about post-war use of the bomb machines and Colossus, isn't it?
Quite a lot that we've been looking into is still confidential, is still classified. Yeah. We are aware of this, but GCHQ have been really good at declassifying the wartime material.
Yeah.
So our researchers have been really lucky. A lot is at the National Archives. And that kind of pivot point at the end of the war, there's quite a lot there about the closing down of the organisation. So where it's in the public domain, we've been able to really interrogate those sources and try and find out how it must have been for those people here. Yes, we know the stories about the Wrens pulling the bomb machines apart and breaking them down to tiny pieces, but there were some bomb machines that survived. 50 of them were then transferred across and kept in case they might be needed again.
Yeah.
The Enigma threat might still exist, even though it wasn't at the end of the war.
Well, we know that the East German police in the late 40s were using Enigma still, don't they?
There was a concern that potential other enemies might also adopt the use of Enigma. And so it made sense that the best technology you had was retained in order to counteract that. Actually, by the 1950s, it was discovered that really there wasn't the need to retain them and that they were being stored in not ideal conditions. And so we actually in the display here have a couple of copies of recently declassified documents that show that decision to destroy the bomb machines, because actually if we needed to counteract this threat again, then better technology could be produced to do that.
And looking around the panels, you seem to be really concentrating on the staff themselves. Are you wanting to focus on the members of staff who went from here to there?
We think it's a really interesting way of looking at how things continued after the war. Our visitors are always keen to find out about the human beings that were part of this big sort of faceless organisation. And what we've been able to do is pick out six particular stories of staff who served at Bletchley Park during the war and then continued on into GCHQ. We haven't outed anybody as GCHQ. We've not revealed anything that isn't already in the public domain. I'm really sorry to say it would be amazing if we could, you know, have this amazing big reveal. But actually what we've been able to do is really find the personal stories that kind of show what that transition must have been like. And these are people that did contribute quite strongly to Bletchley Park's work, but also people who became directors of GCHQ after the war. We've been able to focus on people that perhaps we haven't elsewhere in our exhibitions and our stories that we tell at Bletchley Park. So we've mentioned Margaret Rock, for example, who worked on Abwehr Enigma. We've been able to do a profile of Bill Bonsall, who became Sir Bill Bonsall.
Yeah. We interviewed Arthur Bonsall.
Absolutely,
2 years ago.
In episode number 7 of the podcast. He's got a wonderful interview.
You know better than me.
I do. And it's actually lovely to hear his voice. And he published quite a lot on his area of expertise, which was sort of minor codes and ciphers.
Yeah.
It's not the sexiest part of the work that took place here. It's not Enigma and it's not Colossus. But
it was that stuff, that general day-to-day work that needs to be done, that added to that bigger picture, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And that expertise was really required moving into post-war GCHQ. We've been able to talk about Hugh Alexander as well, the chess champion who actually left, went back to his pre-war job at John Lewis, and then went on to go back to GCHQ and actually became incredibly important in the sort of the crypto section at GCHQ, quite a long-serving member of staff there. It's also really interesting to see that post-war GCHQ is still incredibly secret. The public was unaware of it. We've been able to look at how that was, even in the sort of the 60s until Winterbottom's book in the 1970s, it was all still exceedingly undercover. It does mean that we don't have a lot of material to be able to pull out and show people. But what we have been able to do is identify a few really interesting nuggets and facts, look at the changing name of the organization, look at the buildings that it lived in as well. So Bletchley Park, 1946, GCHQ, or most of GCHQ moved away and then went on to Eastcote, the old outstation, and then from there to Cheltenham, as well as a number of other sites around the country. And it's that sort of progression of the organization, the way it was referred to by those that worked for it, where it worked, and how that becomes more and more modern in response to the challenges that they were facing. That's been really interesting to try and track.
I find it really funny that what starts off as a sign outside GC and CS Bletchley Park War Station, which just says GCHQ on it, as a bit of a put people off what's here, becomes the actual name of the organisation.
Yes, and something that we hadn't really been aware of was the use of the name Government Communication Headquarters from the 1940s.
Yeah.
We've got a photograph of an envelope. It would have been lovely to display the original, but it's actually on display in the Science Museum's exhibition,
right,
addressed to Alastair Denniston, who obviously was here at the start of the war, and yet it's addressed to Government Communication Headquarters, Bletchley. It was interesting for us to find out that Nigel de Grey came up with that name very early on in the war, in 1939. So he came up with this idea of the name as a cover term, and it stuck along with other names. And then gradually it sort of became the most sensible name to use.
I say this to people all the time. Every single time I come here, it doesn't matter how many years I've been coming here, I learn something every time.
If I can actually walk you across our display space to show you a copy of a memo. Now, this is in the National Archives. It's in the public domain, but it's a memo issued in February 1940. It's issued by the Chief Administration Officer, Captain Ridley, and he's quoting the words of the Chief of the Security Service, which describes that Government Communication Headquarters should become the new name on letters and things that were sent to the site. And he said it should be sufficient explanation for the curious to account for the presence of personnel from so many different government departments. So even in 1940, it was being deemed that this was probably a good enough name to use, kind of bland enough, but also kind of describes what was going on here. So that's been really nice to be able to show that GCNCS was GCHQ, literally in the 1940s, as well as the organisation moving into becoming GCHQ that we know today.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.